The role of faith in public life and in government has been hotly debated lately. We'll get some clarity with Dr. Richard Land. And did last night's State of the Union address signal the winding down of the Bush presidency, or a final push for conservative values, or a little of both? This is Jerry Johnson live from Criswell College. Join us as we look at today's news from the Christian worldview for Christ and culture.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy.
I have a dream.
It depends upon what the meaning of the word is.
Yes. And the people who knocked these buildings down will hear all of us soon.
We will not tire, we will not falter, and we will not fail.
Welcome to Jerry Johnson Live. For the next hour, this is your place for relevant discussion of topics in the news and in our culture from a Christian perspective. Your host is Dr. Jerry Johnson, president of Criswell College and Criswell Communications. Later in the show, we'll open the toll-free lines for your questions and comments. You may also email us at talk@jerryjohnsonlive.com. Now, here's your host, Dr. Jerry Johnson.
Some may deny the surge is working, but among the terrorists, there is no doubt. Al-Qaeda is on the run in Iraq, and this enemy will be defeated.
All right, that's President Bush last night, his final State of the Union, his signature issue, the war against the Islamo-terrorist. And he's just saying he's not giving up in Iraq, and we are going to defeat the Islamo-terrorist in the Middle East. Is the president a lame duck president? Did that speech last night sound like a lame duck, or is he really planning to get some things done in the next year? We're going to talk about this speech later on in the program, but the first half of this hour, we're going to talk about God and country. What does God have to do with America? This broadcast is coming to you from Criswell College, and this week we are having the Criswell Theological Lectures on the theme of God and country. And I want you to hear Dr. W.A. Criswell speaking on the theme of America.
To my great sorrow and yours, we have lost our nation to the liberal and the secularist and the humanist, which finally means to the atheist and the infidel. America used to be known as a Christian nation. It is no longer. America is a secular nation.
All right, that's Dr. W.A. Criswell. And really, he was prophetic about America, where we've come from and where we're going. And we're discussing this week at Criswell College, is America one nation under God? What does God have to do with America? And with us to talk about it is Dr. Richard Land. Dr. Richard Land is the president of the Southern Baptist Convention's Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission. He's also the author of a book, The Divided States of America. And I might mention to you, if you're listening on KCBI, you can hear him every day at 12 o'clock for Faith and Family, Monday through Friday, also on Saturday from 11 o'clock to 12 o'clock, Richard Land Live. Dr. Land, welcome back to the program. Sure good to have you with us.
Well, thank you, Jerry. It's good to be with you, and it's always good to be in studio instead of on a phone line.
Usually that's the way we do it.
Yep.
Dr. Land, today you spoke at the Criswell College Chapel. I might mention to our listening audience that you'll be here tomorrow at 10 o'clock. Thursday at 10 o'clock. These sessions are free. They're open to the public. You just come on down to Criswell College, Gaston Avenue in Haskell in East Dallas. Go to our website. Dr. Land will be speaking tomorrow again. What does God have to do with America? Dr. Land, as we just listened to Dr. Criswell, it was a very sad statement that he made, but it was true. And, you know, I'm finding that people, evangelicals and Christians, are timid about the theme of God and country, and most of them have been intimidated by this phrase, the separation of church and state. Today in the chapel, You talked about the origin of this phrase and really Thomas Jefferson's true position on church and state. Could you just lay that out for us right now?
Well, the phrase, a wall of separation between church and state, started, got its origin in a letter that Thomas Jefferson wrote to the Baptist ministers of Danbury, Connecticut, who had written to him basically petitioning him for redress of grievance because of the state government in Connecticut, which had a tax-supported state church, which was constitutional back then under the Constitution until the 14th Amendment was passed. And so he wrote a letter to them, and you have to understand the context. He was writing a letter to Baptist ministers who were being discriminated against and persecuted by a state church. And he said there ought to be a wall of separation between the church and the state. He emphatically and intentionally did not say a separation of religion and state. He said a separation of church and state. And so Jefferson designed the University of Virginia. It's a state university. He designed it with a chapel on the quadrangle. He never envisioned what the secularists and the ACLU types have done with the infamous phrase separation of church and state. And of course, Jefferson's separation of church and state, his wall of separation, is predated by Roger Williams, who back in the 17th century said there had to be a wall between the garden of the church and the wilderness of the state. And the wall was there to protect the church from intrusions by the state, not the other way around. And if you look at our First Amendment, it says Congress shall make no law affecting an establishment of religion, nor interfering with the free exercise thereof. All the restrictions are on the government. You and I can't violate the First Amendment. Only the government can violate the First Amendment.
Now, wait a minute, because you're talking about Thomas Jefferson, and he is the patron saint of the secularist, of the liberals, Americans United for Separation of Church and State, the Civil Liberties Union, and so forth. Would you just lay out again, you did this in chapel today, what are some of the things that happened during that week that Thomas Jefferson penned that letter to the Danbury Baptist about the wall of separation? There's some things that show he was not a strict separationist.
Well, John Leland had basically cut a political deal and negotiated with James Madison to get the First Amendment into the Constitution. The Baptists were not going to support the Constitution because they were fearful of a federal established church. And so Leland and Madison cut a political deal. They met for 3 hours in the snow in Orange County, Virginia, and they cut a deal where Leland would withdraw as an opponent and would begin to support the ratification of the Constitution. And Madison promised that the first Congress, he would introduce an amendment that would say Congress shall make no law affecting the establishment of religion or interfering with the free exercise thereof, which is, of course, the First Amendment. So after Virginia didn't outlaw slavery, as Leland hoped they would, after the Union was formed, he went back to his native Massachusetts and became far more involved in politics than I think a preacher should be. He was a very effective and very active campaigner and organizer for Thomas Jefferson in his bid for the presidency in 1800 against John Adams. And so after Jefferson was made president, the first New Year's, John Leland came to the White House with a 1,000-pound cheese that he was brought by wagon from western Massachusetts, and he stopped every night and would preach. I mean, it was in the papers, you know, the cheese is coming, the cheese is coming. So he would stop and let people see this 1,000-pound cheese, and he would preach a sermon. And so finally, on the first Friday of the new year of 1802, he shows up at the White House at 10:30 in the morning, and Jefferson was expecting him, and Jefferson knew him. And he presented this cheese to the president as a token of affection from the Baptists of western Massachusetts. And he prayed for the president, and he assured the president that no Federalist cows had contributed any milk to this cheese. Only Democrat cows had done so. And he presented the cheese to the president and left. And then Jefferson went back inside on this Friday, had lunch. We don't know if it included any of the cheese or not. And then that very afternoon, he penned the final draft of his famous letter to the Baptist ministers of Danbury, Connecticut. So Friday morning, a Baptist preacher comes and presents him with a 1,000-pound cheese. He has lunch. That afternoon, he pens the final draft of his letter to the Baptist ministers of Danbury, Connecticut. And then that next Sunday morning, the very next Sunday morning, he goes to a worship service in the House of Representatives, the chamber.
That's fascinating.
And John Leland preaches a sermon from the speaker's rostrum of the House with Thomas Jefferson sitting on the front row.
Now, what does that tell you about Jefferson's view, that service in the mm-hmm. House, about Jefferson's view, but also about Leland's view as a Baptist?
Well, they would both be very much more comfortable with religious expression in public places and in the public square than modern secularists and secular fundamentalists would be.
Mm. My guest is Dr. Richard Land. He's written the book, The Divided States of America, What Liberals and Conservatives Are Missing in the God and Country Shouting Match. Dr. Land is recognized by Time Magazine as one of the 25 leading evangelicals in the United States. He holds a bachelor's degree from Princeton University, a doctorate in philosophy from Oxford University. And Dr. Land is lecturing at Criswell College this week at 10 o'clock tomorrow, 10 o'clock Thursday morning. You can come. These are open to the public. They're free. And let me mention, if you missed today's lecture, it's already up on the website. Go to jerryjohnsonlive.com. You can catch up on the lectures tonight and be here tomorrow ready for lecture number two.
Now, you can call them lectures, but I'm preaching.
He is. That's a little bit of teaching and a good bit of preaching. Dr. Land, I want you to listen to somebody who is right now breaking into the American mainstream in terms of sounding like a preacher. He's a political orator. That is Barack Obama. He really is a phenomenon sweeping the country. And I want you to listen to this quote from Obama, and I want your reaction.
Whatever we once were, we are no longer a Christian nation, at least not just. We are also a Jewish nation, and a Muslim nation, and a Buddhist nation, and a Hindu nation, and a nation of non-believers. And even if we did have only Christians in our midst, if we expelled every non-Christian from the United States of America, whose Christianity would we teach in the schools?
Your reaction, Dr. Land.
Well, first of all, if he's going by population, 85% of Americans, 85%. And Barack Obama's a politician, so he understands what 85% means.
It's pretty strong.
85% of Americans self-identify themselves as Christians. Now, you and I both know that not all those people are Christians in the born-again evangelical sense mm-hmm. of that term.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of accepting Jesus as the Son of God and believing in the formulations of Christian doctrine, 85% of Americans claim to be Christians. 91% of Americans claim to believe in God. So the other 6% would be Jews and Muslims and Buddhists, and then we have about 9% who don't believe in anything.
So demographically, we're mostly Christian.
Demographically, we have always been, are largely a self-identified Christian society. Now, I don't use the term Christian nation because it implies to me a redeemed state. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that anybody but individuals are redeemed. But where he's going with this, of course, is he is attempting to set up a straw man. You know, which Christianity would we teach in the public schools? Well, I don't think we ought to be teaching Christianity in the public schools. I'd be happy if they just taught reading and writing and arithmetic successfully, which they haven't been doing successfully for many, many years now. A quarter of our high school graduates from public high schools are functionally illiterate. So I'd be more concerned about them learning how to read and learning how to count and learning some discipline in the public schools. So I think Obama's just setting up a straw man. But let's do understand that for all of his oratorical skills, and he is a very skilled orator, and all of his political skills, he's the second most liberal man in the United States Senate. He has a more liberal voting record than Ted Kennedy.
So right now, on style, he's coming across very strong. But on substance, how will Obama fare later in this election cycle when it comes to the issues? Well, we can talk about that later on in the program. But also, President Bush gave his State of the Union address last night. He talked about immigration. We're going to ask Dr. Land, what is the Christian view on illegal immigration? How do you balance law and order with mercy and grace and helping those in need? We're also going to talk about President Bush on embryonic stem cell research, the sanctity of human life. We're going to play some of that Bush sound, and we're going to ask Dr. Land to respond. And Penn Dexter will be joining us later on in the program. It's Jerry Johnson Live from Criswell College.
churches all over town. Christian radio and TV.
God opens the windows of heaven to you.
The Pledge of Allegiance. And in your pocket on a few coins, a declaration of trust. One nation under God.
We should be looking for candidates who endorse us.
Criswell College presents a lecture series to explore if it's still true. One nation under God. Dr. Richard Land, president of the Ethics and Religious Liberties Commission, will be speaking.
It is our responsibility to speak up for those who cannot speak for themselves.
You are invited.
We've got so much to talk about.
January 29th, 30th, and 31st at the Criswell College in Dallas. We'll hear if America's past is on track with America's future. One nation under God. Listen also for extra coverage from the CRN News team. More of the music and ministry you can trust from the Criswell Radio Network.
You're listening to Jerry Johnson Live. Now here's your host, Dr. Jerry Johnson, president of Criswell College and Criswell Communications.
Many people who pray are the ones who want to go to war, who want to kill fellow human beings. That disturbs me. I think what we need is more love.
All right, that's Senator Gravel, Senator Gravel, I call him, from Alaska. He was running for president of the United States. He has disappeared happily from the scene. But with us to talk about God and country, church and state, Dr. Richard Land of the Southern Baptist Convention Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission. He is lecturing, preaching, teaching at the Criswell College, 10 o'clock tomorrow, 10 o'clock Thursday. You're invited, open to the public. In fact, we'll be giving away some more of our One Nation Under God CDs. All you have to say when you come tomorrow is, I heard about it on Jerry Johnson Live. You get a free one. Also, Dr. Land will be signing his book, The Divided States of America. Dr. Land, when Gravel says the people who pray are the ones who are going to want to go to war, they scare me. What's your reaction to that?
Well, people who don't pray are the ones that scare me. the greatest crimes against humanity in the 20th century have been committed by people who don't pray. Adolf Hitler and the Nazis, Joseph Stalin, yes, and Nikolai Lenin, and Soviet communists, the Chinese communists under Mao Zedong and Chiang Kai-shek, the horrific auto-genocide of Pol Pot in Cambodia, and, of course, the worst place to wake up in the world any morning is North Korea, which, once again, is a place that is committed to atheism. So, you know, like most other things, most other topics, Mr. Gravel has no idea what he's talking about. Mm. By the way, happy anniversary.
Well, thank you.
It's
12 years.
12 years. Well.
And I'm going to be leaving the show midway through. Penn will be taking over to spend some time with Rhonda, my wife. Happy anniversary.
Well, congratulations. I've been married 36 and a half years, and I recommend it highly.
Dr. Land, today in our lectures, in the messages, you challenged us as Christians because we want to see God embraced in the public square, or acknowledged, or at least allowed in the public square. But some Christians fall into a trap of expecting the government to do the work of the church. Mm-hmm. And you talked about government being a caboose, mm-hmm, rather than an engine. Could you explain, mm-hmm, how Christians really should have the right expectation?
Well, first of all, we should expect government to be an umpire, not a cheerleader for religion, not a coach, not a consultant, not a sponsor, and not a censor, and not a suppressor, but an umpire. Make sure everybody plays fair so that everyone has a right to express their views in the public square, whether they're informed by their religious beliefs or whether they're informed by their atheist beliefs or by their agnostic beliefs. Everybody gets their say. And then we as a nation to make a decision. And the wonderful thing about our country is that no decision is final. You know, it's only good till the next election. So if you don't win the argument, you're committed to live with the results of the argument and of the decision and try to make a better argument in the next election. But when you look at societal change, there's no question but that for Christians, we need to understand that government is a caboose, not a locomotive. Government's never going to be the engine for change. It's going to reflect change that is taking place in the hearts and the minds of the people. What we have to have is revival and awakening, and it is the faith of the people in the God of Scripture, the faith being the coal, the God being the locomotive, and the engines the caboose. Mm-hmm. I mean, the government's the caboose.
So government will really follow.
That's right. It's a lagging indicator, not a leading indicator.
Well, let's talk about some of the issues that Christians really are concerned about.
I did give one example today, which I think is helpful, and that is that in 1858, we had 1 million people added to the church rolls in the northern United States as a result of the Great Revival of 1858, and that elected Abraham Lincoln. So you had a spiritual awakening on the part of the people, and they elected a government leader who effected change.
And the country was able to deal decisively at a great cost with the issue of slavery. And we've been talking about really the value of the sanctity of human life. President Bush last night hit a couple of life issues. I want to go to the immigration issue first, because a lot of Christians see this as a law and order issue. Others say, look, this is about people, the value of human life. We need to treat these people with dignity. Here's President Bush last night on illegal immigration.
Illegal immigration is complicated, but it can be resolved, and it must be resolved in a way that upholds both our laws and our highest ideals.
Dr. Land, how do Christians balance concern for law and order with the New Testament commands to love others and to help them?
Well, all I can do is give you how this Christian does it. Christians are going to have to make up their own minds about the proper balance. But we're citizens of two kingdoms. We're citizens of an earthly kingdom. Romans 13 says that we're to be obedient to the civil magistrate, which is a divinely ordained institution, for conscience sake. But Philippians 3:20 says we're also citizens of heaven. We're part of the colony of heaven. As citizens of the earthly kingdom, we have a right to expect the government to punish those who do evil, to reward those who do that which is good, to enforce the law. As citizens of the heavenly kingdom, we're told to give a cup of cold water in Jesus' name, to feed the hungry, to house the homeless, to clothe the naked. And so we have a ministry of compassion. The Good Samaritan tells us that, if nothing else. And so we have as Americans, we have a right to expect our government to obey the law and to enforce the law. And if the law is a bad law, then let's change the laws. But that means securing the border. It means enforcing the laws against employers who employ people illegally and who exploit them. And it means not rewarding people who have come here illegally ahead of those who want to come here legally. But I think that we also have an obligation and a responsibility to reach out to these people that are here, regardless of their legal status, and to, if they're hungry, to feed them. If they're thirsty, to give them drink. If they're naked, to clothe them. If they don't have a roof over their heads, to give them shelter.
And to pray and evangelize as well.
I would urge every Christian church, Baptist and otherwise, in the country, to start teaching English and use Good News for Modern Man, the paraphrase of the New Testament, written at a fourth grade reading level. It's consciously written at a fourth grade reading level. And use Good News for Modern Man as the text. People who are here who don't speak English understand that if they want to access the American dream, they have to learn to speak English. Mm. There's a 3-year waiting period in some parts of the country to get into an English class. What great ministry we can have. Teach these people to read English, and by doing so, teach them the Bible.
Dr. Land, another issue the president spoke of last night, and he has certainly held the line on this, and that is the sanctity of innocent human life. Here he is on embryonic stem cell research.
On matters of life and science, we must trust in the innovative spirit of medical researchers and empower them to discover new treatments while respecting moral boundaries. In November, we witnessed a landmark achievement when scientists discovered a way to reprogram adult skin cells to act like embryonic stem cells. This breakthrough has the potential to move us beyond the divisive debates of the past by extending the frontiers of medicine without the destruction of human life. So we're expanding funding for this type of ethical medical research. And as we explore promising avenues of research, we must also ensure that all life is treated with the dignity it deserves, And so I call on Congress to pass legislation that bans unethical practices such as the buying, selling, patenting, or cloning of human life.
Dr. Land, we have about 2 minutes left in this segment. Your reaction?
Well, first of all, the president has not gotten near the credit he should for this medical breakthrough, because if he had not held the line against enormous pressure had allowed federal funding that resulted in the killing of unborn babies, the creation of embryos for the express purpose of killing them and to harvest their stem cells, these doctors and these researchers would never have had the impetus and the motivation to go back into the lab and to come up with something which is even better than embryonic stem cells. This is the ability to take a person's own skin cells and reduce them to the embryonic state, so there's not even the problem with dealing with rejection that you would have with embryonic stem cells. And it would never have happened if the president hadn't held the line. The president has been courageous, and he has saved us in this country from an absolutely colossal moral tragedy. Thank God we didn't listen to the moral pygmies like Ron Reagan, the son of the late president, who became a mindless puppet for the pro-embryonic stem cell research industry. You know, Ron Reagan is as good an argument as I know for why we don't have hereditary monarchies.
Our guest is Dr. Richard Land. He's written the book, The Divided States of America. He is preaching, teaching at Criswell College at 10 o'clock tomorrow, 10 o'clock Thursday. The Criswell Theological Lectures, they're open to the public. We invite you to join us. You can go to jerryjohnsonlive.com and hear today's message and be caught up and get here tomorrow and hear what he has to say. Now, I want you to listen quickly, folks, to Teddy Kennedy endorsing Barack Obama.
I feel change in the air. What about you?
All right, change in the air. Is change always good, though? What about a change on our policy towards human life? Dr. Land just spoke about President Bush's policies. It's very clear that the leftists, the liberals, the Democrats, the Obamas, the Clintons, they do not stand up for the sanctity of innocent human life. Do we really want change there? Well, we're going to talk about those issues and judges when we come back. Penna Dexter is going to be taking the wheel, so we do have some change in the air that we can affirm. Penna Dexter coming in now with Dr. Richard Land. You don't want to miss it. This is Jerry Johnson Live from Criswell College. We'll be right back.
Listening to Jerry Johnson Live. Now here's Penna Dexter.
We must trust in the ability of free peoples to make wise decisions and empower them to improve their lives for their futures.
That's President Bush last night in the State of the Union address, and he really had the theme of trust in that speech. He also talked about the elections and sort of tried to tie his speech and his accomplishments to what was coming later. But this theme of trusting the American people to make individual decisions and then going on to empowering them to improve their lives and their futures. And I thought this was sort of the way that this whole race, this whole term of office under President Bush has really kind of had those two themes. Dr. Richard Land is with me. And Dr. Land, when you look at President Bush, he is a conservative to the core, but he also sort of has a government side to him where he feels there's a strong role for government. He's done that during his term of office. And throughout that speech, he talked about that in various ways. Do you feel like that's kind of how he is? Sometimes we criticize him for that.
Well, look, there are Reagan conservatives and then there's Bush conservatism. There's Reaganism and Bushism. And they're different. Let me, in the interest of full disclosure, say that I'm probably more of a Bushism person than I am a Reaganism person, personally. And conservatives can have legitimate disagreements about that. Reaganism basically says government is bad. Government is the enemy of freedom. We need to have as little government as possible. The government has to do some things, like, you know, defend the country, the armed forces, et cetera. But you want to keep government as small as possible and maximize liberty. Bushism says there is a role for government to play. Government can be an enabler. Government can help people to make good decisions for themselves and to free themselves to make decisions for what's best for themselves. Now, that's opposed to the paternalism of liberalism, which says people are not capable of making good choices for themselves, so we're going to make the choices for you. That's what Kerry and Gore and Clinton would say. But a good example of Bush believing that government has a role to play is the No Child Left Behind legislation, mm-hmm. which says that our public schools aren't working as well as they should, particularly among our poorest people, and that we need to use the federal government's leverage to try to help the schools be better than they are and to equalize opportunity. You know, a long time ago in this country, we made a basic decision, which I think is the right decision, that we were going to focus on opportunity as opposed to equality. That we were, instead of focusing on equality of outcome, we were going to maximize opportunity. But if you're going to do that, you got to have opportunity. Otherwise, it becomes grossly unfair. And if you by the accident of birth, preclude large segments of our population from exposure to a good education, which is the key to getting ahead in American life, by having them forced to attend urban, poor schools that don't do an adequate job of teaching, then you are short-circuiting and squelching opportunity. And you're also wasting the most precious natural resource we have. Now, I know some conservatives say, well, you know, our forefathers did it on their own. Actually, I would say that a good example of Bushism and government being a positive force is the Homestead Act. All those settlers who went west got 440 acres of free land from the U.S. government. Mm-hmm. And then perhaps in my own lifetime, probably the most transformative government action in the history of our nation was the GI Bill after World War II, where the government underwrote the free education for college at any college, Princeton, Harvard, wherever, for all World War II veterans, and gave them a monthly stipend to allow them to feed themselves and their family while they were going to school. Now, that has been an enormous bonanza for the United States. The economic miracle that has been the United States in the last half of the 20th century was fueled by the talent, the energy, and the abilities of those men who had served their country, who came home and got a leg up by getting a free college education. People whose families had never had anyone go to college, they were enabled to go to college by government acting as a positive force. And so I think that the president, I personally think the president is right, that government can play a role. That's what he was trying to do with the individual retirement accounts and Social Security, which would have been a tremendous boost for people who are in their 20s and 30s. They would have gotten a much better deal out of Social Security had they been allowed to invest 2% of their contributions into individual retirement accounts in gotten much better return on their investment. It would have been a wonderful deal for my children, for instance.
You know, he chastised Congress a little bit for not acting on Social Security, and I think he was a little bit hopeful that that would happen, but I'm not sure how realistic that is. Now, along those lines, Dr. Land, I think our tax policy is something that President Bush has strong opinions about, and of course, one of the great successes of his presidency, which he discussed in the speech last night, was the tax cuts, the economy, and some of the growth in jobs and many things as a result of that. And he said in the speech last night, unless Congress acts, most of that tax relief given over the past years will actually be taken away.
With all the other pressures on their finances, American families should not have to worry about the federal government taking a bigger bite out of their paychecks. There's only one way to eliminate this uncertainty: make the tax relief permanent.
And again, later in the speech, he said the tax relief for the people of America should be permanent.
And members of Congress should know, if any bill raises taxes, reaches my desk, I will veto it.
All right, that's raising taxes. He also talked about earmarks, and that was a big theme of the speech. As a matter of fact, he said he was going to formulate an executive order with regard to earmarks that aren't passed by Congress. He won't let that happen. So in a sense, even though some people say he's a lame duck president and people are asking questions about whether he'll get anything done in this last year, that would be an important achievement, wouldn't it?
Well, it certainly would. Now, it'll get challenged in court. I mean, there's no question about that. But if it holds up in court, it will be a huge thing because a lot of these earmarks do not, no one ever sees them. They just vote on them. And, and he's making a very important constitutional point, and one that, that if he does this and is successful in implementing this by executive order, then he's going to be presenting his successor with a fait accompli. Even if it's a Democrat, that Democrat's going to have to think long and hard about actually rescinding an executive order that protects us against these grotesque earmark bills. And so the president is taking a very positive step. You know, the president, the presidency, until his last day in office, the presidency is a position of influence and power, and it is not inconsequential. Now, the president does lose some leverage, and he's lost more than most second-term presidents because of the decision he made to not pick a vice president who could succeed him.
Right.
The reality is that it was known from the beginning that Dick Cheney would not be succeeding him, that his health challenges would preclude him running for president of the United States. And so if let's say that, let's just say for argument's sake, that Bush had picked someone in either the first, if for the first term or the second term, to be his vice president, who was a viable candidate for that office.
Some of us thought he should switch gears in the middle, and it might have been a good idea.
Well, it might have. We'll never know. But let's say he'd, let's just say he'd pick someone like Bill Frist. Well, then Bill Frist would have been the odds-on favorite to be the nominee. Well, that gives the president more leverage because the people in the Senate and the House realize they might have to deal with his successor, who is his vice president, which is sort of like a third Bush term. Mm-hmm. And so they have to give more credence to his threats longer and longer into the term, at least until the November election, than they do with the president they know is not going to have a vice president succeed him and who, will, even if it's a Republican, will not be tied to him and to his policies the way a vice president would.
Speaking of Vice President Cheney, last night, I don't know if you saw the speech, but, you know, him, he's sitting behind the president, as he always does, as president of the Senate, and then Nancy Pelosi is there. And, of course, he's just pretty stoic looking. Mm-hmm. And I was just very curious as to how Nancy Pelosi would look. First of all, I thought she should have worn a power color, black mm-hmm. or red or something, instead of lavender. But she couldn't decide when to stand up and when mm-hmm. not to stand up. She couldn't bring herself to stand up and applaud mm-hmm. the success of the surge, which I thought was very interesting. But, you know, she says that she's happy that it's President Bush's last yeah. State of the Union address. It's kind of fun to see that. But this is the observation I have, Dr. Land, about President Bush. And I know that you know him. And, you know, he seemed to enjoy giving the speech. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, as he was leaving, my husband and I just kept mm-hmm. watching as he was leaving. We wanted to just see him interacting mm-hmm. with everybody. And people would say to him, great speech. And he'd say, I enjoyed giving it, which seemed mm-hmm. like he did. And so I thought that was very interesting as you watched him going. I think this is a president who enjoys himself. He's had some tough times, mm-hmm. But he's taken some themes that have been important to him, and he has accomplished mm-hmm. them, despite the criticism, hasn't he?
Yes, and, you know, it's interesting. I don't know if you saw the Fox News special that was on the night before on Sunday night about Bush. They gave the reporter unprecedented access, and they talked to his speechwriters. And his speech, one his head speechwriter said, I've been edited by Bill Buckley, and I've been edited by the editors of the Wall Street Journal. And he said, George W. Bush is the toughest editor I've ever had. He says he goes over the speech. They sit down, and the president gives them some idea what he wants to say. And they come up with a first draft, and he goes through it with a fine-tooth comb.
Makes it his own.
Yes. He's very hands-on, very hands-on. And these two guys said, he's tough, man. He really wants to, you know, he goes through every line in the speech. Now, so I think he enjoys delivering it because it's him. It's George W. Bush. I think he does enjoy the presidency, and I think it's part of it's his faith. He's going to do what he believes is the best thing for the country, and he's going to leave the judgment to history, and he's content with that. And I think he feels confident that history will judge him far better than he's being judged at present. And I think that he believes that he is going to be, or he hopes he's going to be, the Harry Truman of his time. I believe he will be the Harry Truman of his time. When Harry Truman left office, he had a 28% approval rating the day he left office. That's lower than Nixon the day he resigned. And yet, today, Harry Truman is considered the third most consequential president of the 20th century.
We appreciate them later sometimes. Well, Dr. Richard Land is with me, and the lectures were very well attended today, but there's room for you tomorrow. You can get more information, www.criswell.edu. We'll talk a little politics right after this.
Churches all over town. Christian radio and TV.
God opens the windows of heaven to you.
The Pledge of Allegiance. And in your pocket, on a few coins, a declaration of trust. One nation under God.
We should be looking for candidates who endorse us.
Criswell College presents a lecture series to explore if it's still true. One nation under God. Dr. Richard Land, president of the Ethics and Religious Liberties Commission, will be speaking.
It is our responsibility to speak up for those who cannot speak for themselves.
You are invited.
We've got so much to talk about.
January 29th, 30th, and 31st at the Criswell College in Dallas. We'll hear if America's past is on track with America's future. One nation under God. Listen also for extra coverage from the CRN News team. More of the music and ministry you can trust from the Criswell Radio Network.
You're listening to Jerry Johnson Live. Now here's Penna Dexter.
Let there be no doubt. We are all committed to seeing a Democratic president in 2008.
That is Ted Kennedy, and the elephant in the living room last night, Dr. Land, was Barack Obama sitting next to Teddy Kennedy after a day of Teddy Kennedy having endorsed him, and then Hillary Clinton somewhere else in the room.
Just the same aisle, but they didn't even speak. There were cameras that showed that they never even made eye contact.
It was very interesting. So we're going to get to the Democrat race, but first I want to talk about the Republican race because, of course, today is the Florida primary, and it's the most important primary so far for the Republicans. And first of all, I teased last Friday when I spoke with you that I would ask you where Fred Thompson's votes are going. Some people in Florida have already voted for Fred Thompson, but where are most of his votes going, do you think?
Well, in South Carolina, we know because the exit polls asked all the people, the 16.5% of South Carolinians who voted for Thompson, they asked them who their second choice was. And a third said McCain, a third said Huckabee, and a third said Romney. So we
In other words, we have no idea.
Well, no, I think we do. I think we know that, South Carolina is not that different than Florida, that probably about a third of the Thompson support went to Huckabee, and about a third of Thompson's support went to McCain. And about a third went to Romney. Notice that none of it went to Giuliani.
Mm-hmm.
None of it went to Ron Paul.
Does Romney replace Thompson, in a sense?
Well, for the third who supported him, I mean, I think, look, the whole problem in the Republican primaries is that there is no Ronald Reagan. There is no George W. Bush. There is no one who represents all three legs of the Reagan coalition. They all have some warts. Giuliani is fits two of the three. I mean, he's strong on military. He's strong on the economy, but he's terrible on social issues. Huckabee is absolutely fantastic on social issues, but more problematic to the economic conservatives and somewhat problematic to the foreign policy conservatives. You have McCain, who's great on foreign policy, but who is a stinker on economics.
Kind of a Democrat.
Well, he's a stinker on economics. He's terrible on economics, and he's only lukewarm on the social issues. So people are having to make a choice and having to sort of prioritize which of those they think is most important, and along with it, of course, electability, who can beat Hillary or Obama.
All right. We have Dr. Richard Land here in the studio. He's here in Dallas. And tomorrow and Thursday from 10 to 11 here at the Criswell College at Gaston and Haskell, he will be preaching, he says, lecturing. And it was pretty crowded today. There's still room for you. Fox News was here videotaping this and interviewing students. And this has been a real happening. So we hope that you will join us. If you need more information, you can go to www.criswell.edu. Also tomorrow, Dr. Gary Cass will join us on his new book, Christian Bashing, The Last Acceptable Bigotry. That ought to be a lot of fun. Well, I want to go to Bill Clinton because he has been out on the campaign trail for his wife. And here's something he said when he was interviewed by a reporter after the South Carolina primary.
What does it say about Barack Obama that it takes two of you to beat him? That's just debate, too. Jesse Jackson won South Carolina twice in 84 and 88. And he ran a good campaign, and Senator Obama's run a good campaign. He's run a good campaign everywhere. He's a good candidate with a good organization.
Dr. Land, a lot of people are saying that that is just one of the times that Bill Clinton has been playing the race card on behalf of his wife. And is this helping her or hurting her?
Well, I think it's hurting her. I think it's hurting him a lot. Mm-hmm. I think it's hurting his post-presidential image a lot. And I'm disappointed. I'm not shocked. I'm not shocked at anything the Clintons do. But I am disappointed because I think it is overtly. I think look, Bill. I would say the same thing about Bill Clinton that Richard Nixon said when David Frost asked him why didn't he just say like Reagan did that Reagan said I don't have any memory of the Contra thing, and Nixon sort of smiled into the camera and said, well, I could never use stupidity as an excuse, and neither can Bill Clinton. I mean, Richard Nixon and Bill Clinton, two of the smartest guys that we've had in the White House in the last century in terms of IQ. Bill Clinton knows exactly what he's doing. That Jesse Jackson response is a classic example. Why did he say Jesse Jackson carried South Carolina in 84 and 88? John Edwards carried South Carolina in 2004. Why didn't he say John Edwards carried South Carolina in 2004? He said Jesse Jackson because he's trying to make Barack Obama the black candidate. He's trying to ghettoize Barack Obama. That's exactly what he's doing. And it's interesting to me, it's really entertaining for me to sit by and watch these liberals and these media people, when Bill Clinton was kneecapping Republicans and conservatives all these years with this kind of activity, they didn't mind it. But boy, when it's them, that when they're the object of this kneecapping by Hillary and Bill, all of a sudden they're seeing the Clintons in a new light. And I do think that we're looking at a sort of a generational shift here. More and more, Bill Clinton's campaign was a bridge to the future, and his presidential library, that double wide contraption in Little Rock, which is supposed to be a bridge to the future, but it looks like a double wide trailer hanging over a riverbank. Hillary is increasingly looking like a bridge to the past, not the future.
Dr. Land, I want to go back to the Republicans really quick before the end of the program, because there are some people out there who really don't have a candidate. They're still very confused. And, there has been a move among conservatives and Christians for a third-party candidate. Mm-hmm. And, we've heard names like John Ashcroft floated, mm-hmm. and we've heard, the Constitution Party floated, and I just want to know what you think of that idea, especially when you think of a presidency of somebody who might get mm-hmm. some of the same things done the Democrats would get done.
Well, look, third parties are notorious for their failure rate in American society. Only one third party has ever been successful, and that was the Republican Party. And it replaced the Whig Party because the Whig Party refused to be – the Whig Party and the Democrat Party both wanted to be pro-choice on slavery. And the American people had reached a critical mass of anti-slavery sentiment. And so the weaker of the two parties, the Whig Party, died and was replaced by the Republican Party. I think that the greatest impetus to a third party is going to die tonight. And that was Rudy Giuliani. If Rudy Giuliani had been the nominee, then a lot of pro-life people like me would have had to either make the choice not to vote or to vote for a symbolic third party who wouldn't win but would give us an opportunity to have a protest vote. But I think that the big news out of Florida tonight, whoever wins, is that Rudy Giuliani is going to finish well back in the pack, and that Rudy Giuliani's presidential quest as a Republican is over.
So
and
that's the Republican good news. Party can continue to be the pro-life party, right, which is what a lot of people were worried
that's
about.
That's right. Because the reality is, unless something very, very, very strange happens, is that either John McCain or Mitt Romney are going to be the nominee of the party. And they're both pro-life. I mean, there's no question that on the basic issue, they're both pro-life. I certainly would like for Mitt Romney to have been pro-life longer and for John McCain to be pro-life on embryonic stem cells. But they're both pro-life.
Dr. Richard Land, thank you so much for being with us today. And ladies and gentlemen, come see him tomorrow, 10 a.m. at Criswell College, and join us tomorrow night.
You've been listening to Jerry Johnson Live, a Christian Worldview radio show.
Join Dr. Jerry Johnson, president of Criswell College and Criswell Communications, Monday through Friday at 5 p.m. for an hour of relevant discussion of news and culture from a Christian perspective.